I got up at 5 in the morning and I went to bed about midnight for 5 years. Every day. I worked.
You're listening to On the Record Off Script. My name is Mark Coffin. I'm your host, and this is a special summer edition of the podcast. We are taking a break from our usual format for the rest of the summer, where we walk step by step through the career path of ex-MLAs. And for the summer, we're going to be sharing more or less long-form cuts of the interviews we took with former MLAs directly, so featuring one individual each week. It'll give you a better understanding of who that person is and what their experience was, and also a better sense of what our interviews sounded like, which were, the ones we'll share with you are quite fascinating and interesting. Characters and individuals, all of whom share pretty passionate and articulate thoughts and reflections about their time in public life, but don't necessarily agree with one another. So you'll get a range of former MLAs from different parties, different backgrounds, and in many cases, different opinions from within the same party. So these are the ones that kind of stuck out in our minds the most while we were going along with this project, and in many ways provided a bit of a frame for thinking about some of the comments of the other MLAs as well. So I hope you enjoy, and this gives us a bit of a break from our usual task of writing and producing the episodes, which takes a fair amount of work. Speaking of which, if you are a regular listener to the podcast and you haven't yet become a supporter, consider dropping by offscript.ca/donate and making a small contribution to help cover the costs of the production of this podcast. All your donations go directly to the cost of producing the podcast. And if you're not able to do that, or you'd like to do something in addition to that, we'd really like it if you could go to Apple Podcasts and find this podcast's page, search for On the Record Off Script, and give us a bit of a review. There's a star rating and place for comments. Both of them are helpful in getting the word out about the podcast so other people with interests similar to yours can discover something that they also might like. All right, on to this week's featured interview, and that is with former Truro Bible Hill MLA Eleanor Norrie. So in doing this ex-interview project with former MLAs, it became clear early on that the project would be a bit of a puzzle. Nova Scotia politics works differently for each MLA, and that varies depending on who you are, what the color of your skin is, what gender you identify with, what era you served in, what part of the province you come from, what party you belong to, and who was leading the party at that time. All kinds of variables, and lots of people have very different experiences that you might think would have had similar experiences, but it wasn't the case. Trying to understand how all of this actually shakes down in practical terms is no small task, but each interview we did gave us another piece of the puzzle to how Nova Scotia politics actually works. In today's podcast, we'll share the tape from my conversation with Eleanor Norrie, a former MLA from the Truro Bible Hill area, and one who held several different cabinet portfolios in John Savage's Liberal government in the 90s. I enjoyed this chat with Eleanor because she offered several pieces of the puzzle. A couple of pieces that were surprising for me were how she, as a first-time candidate, was invited into the design of the party's platform, as I assume were many other candidates at her time, which isn't something that more recent candidates will be familiar with, at least not the ones I've been speaking with. And she talks about her negotiations with Texan oil tycoons around the Sable offshore project and the royalty rights to the drilling that was done there. And I think most interestingly, Eleanor was responsible, or she was part of the cabinet that decided to close the Nova Scotia Teachers College or Normal College in Truro, which was a very controversial decision at the time, but also significant because it was in her riding. And she talks about the challenges of doing that and carrying a message that she believed was good for the province home to her riding, where obviously people were not as convinced that it was good for anybody. All right, here's my conversation with Eleanor Norrie. One thing I forgot to mention while we were in the studio recording that introduction was that in my interview with Eleanor, it took place in the fall of 2015, which was the same day that Justin Trudeau and his cabinet were getting sworn in as the new Liberal government, and the cabinet was equal seats for men and women, both of which are things that Eleanor and I reference at points during our discussion, since the TV was on mute in the corner of the room.
What did you do before you entered politics?
Well, I was 50, just around 50 when I got officially involved in an elected capacity. Prior to that, I began, first of all, I was a school teacher prior to being married. And then I was a pretty well a stay-at-home mom, if you will, with my three daughters. And got heavily involved in activities that they were involved in on a volunteer basis. And it just, for some reason or other, I would always get heavily involved. And I think every organization I ever got involved in, I ended up being the chair or the president. I just, I don't say no easily to getting work done. And then and my husband, just after, well, I guess we were after we were married, opened up a restaurant in town. So I was involved with that. As my children got older, I got more involved in that. So I just sort of helped him from a behind-the-scenes point of view, doing books and that sort of thing. But I got heavily involved in the arts community, and I got heavily involved in activities, sporting activities with my children, social activities as well, you know, all the things young people get involved in, and through high school. So I was just became a sort of a well-known volunteer, if you will, and kept doing that right up until the time I was asked to run. All through that as well, I was always volunteering and involved politically with our local liberal associations.
What made you get involved in the Liberal Party?
It was family tradition. My mother was always, herself was always heavily involved, and my mother-in-law, once I was married, and I knew her prior to that, but once I was married, her name was Margaret Norrie, and she was the first woman to run for the legislature here in Nova Scotia. She was defeated. She was defeated by Bob Stanfield and G.I. Smith. It was a dual riding at the time. So she had a major influence. You know, she's one of my mentors, and I admired her a great deal. She's a role model for me.
Sorry, and was your mother or grandma?
My mother-in-law.
Your mother-in-law.
Husband's okay. Mother. Uh-huh. And she eventually became a senator. Was appointed by Pierre Trudeau. Uh-huh. And so I was always surrounded by people interested in politics. And my brother-in-law ran also in 1970. I think that's the first election I really got heavily, heavily involved because it was family and that sort of thing. And I just got caught up in the whole thing, and I got caught up in the Liberal Party, and I liked the people, and I liked the fun of it all, you know, the challenge. And so that sort of led me down a path that I didn't know where I was going, but where I ended up was to be asked to represent the Liberals and run for nomination.
Mm. And when you were deciding to run for nomination, did you have any conversations with your mother-in-law?
No, she was passed away by that time, and so had my mother. My mother was ill just when they were talking about me running, and her only comment to me was, "Oh, Eleanor, I don't want you to get hurt," because politics is, she understood politics more than I do, I think. So I was always sort of regretted the fact that neither one of them were there when I actually did win the seat and then went into cabinet. So it was, you know, it was quite a thrill and quite a, well, it's a challenge, but a real opportunity.
And when you say you were asked to run, who was it that asked you to run?
The local Liberals got involved, and there was a couple that were heavily involved in the community that said, you know, why don't you let your name stand for nomination? So I did a lot of research on what was happening at the time within politics. John Buchanan had resigned. You could see the door opening up for possibility for change in government as well. So it was an opportunity. It was, timing was right, and the whole bit. And at the time, there was quite upheaval and split within the Conservative Party, or the Progressive Conservative Party, in the Torrobaba Hill riding. This is actually Colchester North. I'm about 50 meters from the border. but I grew up in Truro, and I knew. And so it was an opportunity. There was going to be a change in government. You knew that. There was going to be a split in this riding. So it was an opportunity to take advantage of that to win the seat. Typically and historically, progressive conservative riding since, well, before that, but really since Bob Stanfield's time, because he was from Truro. So I did a lot of research on all of that and the possibility of getting the nomination, number one. Tough for women to get nominations. I think it's maybe improving now, and I think this will, what's happening here today will change that issue. It won't be as quite as difficult for women to get the nomination.
You mean the gender parity in cabinet?
That, and just the openness and the fact that so many women won. I think more women ran and more women won in this election and in historically. There's more seats, but still. I remember going to visit the legislature when I was in high school. I mean, it was just a room full of white, suited men that, you know, it was just, when I would be, I think I would be in grade 11 or 12 at that time, and it's just something that would never, a young woman would never dream of ever finding herself sitting down there. But I remember looking down and being in awe of it, but also, you know, It just never crossed my mind, gee, I'd like to do that someday, because it was just not a possibility.
You say it was hard for women to get the nomination.
I think, well, yeah, it wasn't hard. In that day and age, I would say during the, up until about in the 1990s, because I don't know, whether it's the word hard or not. It was just a difficult thing for people to accept that the women would possibly win the seat. So if there was a woman running, they may try to get a man to run against her for the nomination because they want to win the seat. Because it wasn't happening a lot in the, you know, Alexis McDonough was one of the first to, you know, have a seat in the House, you know, and that was with a different party. But to go to the old guard parties, the Progressive Conservatives, the Liberals, they get the nomination in order to win the seat. I would say that the inner circle within the parties in all the different ridings, you think, well, we want to get that seat. The possibility of that seat, we put a man there. And quite often you'd find the women in seats that they're not going to win anyway. I mean, that was the thinking. And I think it was still that way. And I think what's happening with Justin Trudeau right now, what's happening with across the country, with a whole new change in how the attitudes of people, the attitudes of young people, that'll be historic. I mean, historically gone. It'll be that attitude.
But, and so, I mean, it sounds like it was hard to get the nomination, but how?
I wasn't challenged.
You weren't challenged, so there was no opponent for the nomination.
So, no. I worked really hard to get the nomination. I turned my family, my breakfast nook into an office, and I rented a computer. In those days, there weren't many computers around. I didn't have one.
This is 1990.
Okay. And, well, I was nominated in 1992, and the election was in 93.
Okay.
So, you know, and I just signed up members to the party, and I worked everybody that was a member of the party. And I went to that nomination with two speeches because I wasn't still certain that there was going to be somebody run against me. There was no rumors of it, but I was absolutely sure that there was going to be somebody to challenge me for the nomination that night.
What was it like running in the general election campaign?
In 93, it was John Savage. I actually was co-chaired the convention for the leadership when he won the leadership. So I hadn't supported anybody in the leadership because I was chairing it. So I was heavily involved with people right across the province in running that leadership convention, which was really exciting. It was a really exciting time for the Liberal Party. And there were five of them, and we didn't know who, Don Down or John Savage, which one was going to win it. And that was the famous telephone. I don't know how old you were. If you remember, we had a MT&T came to, or Maritime Tel, I don't know what it was called at the time, offered us the opportunity to use telephone voting. So you phoned in the vote. So we had people signed up, and everybody was given a PIN. And they were to call in, and then the PIN to identify them, and then they had a number for each candidate. So we sat around, and they were sure this was going to happen, and everything was going to be perfect, and they had no hiccups to it. The morning of the vote, we were at the World Trade Center in Halifax, at the Port Royal Room. We had banks of telephones all lined up. We had a lot of people did come to the convention. But everybody dialed at the same time right across the province, and everything went crash. There was no vote. And, I mean, people were so new to the process. I remember seeing some of the former, or at the time they were MLAs, standing there, keep dialing the number, waiting for somebody to say thank you, like, hello, this is not going to work. So we had to call a halt to the whole thing, and we had to regroup, and we had a crisis team in place. And I don't know if it altered the outcome of that vote or not. I don't know.
So how did the vote actually take place?
So then MT&T had to finance the whole new paper ballot. And then also, we set up a paper ballot, but they also set up a telephone system that was going to work. So we had to redo the whole convention in 3 weeks. But the sky was the limit from a cost point of view. You know, we just did what we had to do. It was kind of an exciting time, and it was the famous telephone vote. So
I
hadn't
heard that story before.
Oh, that was quite exciting. So anyway, it did put me in a position of a lot of notoriety. I was co-chair. There were two women co-chairing that.
So what was the election campaign like, the general election?
It was exciting. It was sort of came in the heels of that vote, John Savage became very well known. He had been the mayor of Dartmouth, and he had good advisors around him, and they invited every candidate in on a weekly basis as we were setting platforms up.
And what were those meetings about?
They were setting policy, and they had for every department of government, municipal affairs and finance and human resources, housing, education, health, and we were part of the designing the platform before it was released. And we brought in some major sweeping changes, which made us very unpopular, but they've all worked out to be, from the Department of Environment, we brought in the whole recycling, waste management. Brought in emergency medicine, brought in the whole new system of ambulances and the healthcare system. And this is one of the issues that really was difficult for me, being from Truro Bible Hill. The teachers' college was in Truro Bible Hill. We discussed at great length, and I did a lot of research on the education of teachers because I knew it was going to affect me. So as a result of all of that, when we brought it in, the teachers' college was closed, and it was a 142-year-old facility and institution here. So it was part of my demise, having closed that.
And when you were part of that decision?
Oh, yes, all the caucus would be part of it. I mean, we had a lot of debate and a lot of questions asked. I mean, I didn't agree with it without knowing what I was doing and without a lot of research and looking right across Canada and the United States and what they were doing with teacher education and the results of the students coming out of the different systems with the different, math and reading especially. Math was really, arithmetic and math was changing at that time, and I think it required more of a professional university setting. The teachers' college was good. I went to teachers' college. I went there as a normal college. I was a student, a graduate, alumni. it was all from a very practical point of view. And I don't know that I was well educated enough. I had all the practice I needed. I had all the theory I needed. But I don't know that those of us who went through there, compared to what's happening now, had the education that 4 years of an arts degree or a science degree would give you. In that setting. So anyway, that's a whole other topic.
maybe we'll come back to that because I'm curious.
So that was all part of the discussions.
In the platform development.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't decided at that time what to do with educating teachers, but it was talking about changing the education system and changing how we deliver education and that sort of thing, like we reduce the number of school boards and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe we'll come back to that a bit later because it sounds like it was part of the decisions you had made as government. So you were elected as MLA, and at the same time, did you move right into cabinet?
Yeah, it was right up like that.
You never would have been on the back bench.
Oh, and I think it would be an advantage to either be in the back bench or to be in opposition. And I think opposition would be a better training ground before you went into cabinet than even a back bench.
Hmm. Why do you say that?
Well, because when you're I would love to have been in opposition sometime, either before or after, because then you can, I always felt, just for an example, that I have a lot of admiration for Lex McDonough now, but in those days, she was always in opposition. So the sky was the limit. She could say anything, knowing she'd never be in government, to try to implement it. So the books are wide open then on what you think could happen, and then you have to hold the government at account what they're doing. So it's just a real good learning experience. It would be a good place to learn the system in opposition before you went into government or even into cabinet.
Hmm. So how did you learn? I
got up at 5 in the morning and I went to bed about midnight for 5 years, every day. I worked. I had my MLA office here in Truro, and I was part of the caucus in Halifax as well as the being in cabinet. So it really was a learning curve because just to learn the ropes just from a strictly day-to-day, where's the bathroom, how do you find the key to get into your office to where your office is. And not only was I in cabinet, I was also in what in those days was called priorities and planning, the Treasury Board, if you will. So I had Tuesday mornings with priorities and planning, and then I had Wednesday morning with caucus, and I had Thursday mornings with cabinet, as well as you know, and then when the house sat, you'd have to prepare for question period, and you'd have to learn your portfolio. I was first appointed to the Civil Service Commission, and I had other smaller. I had the status of women, I had sport and recreation, and others that I was responsible for. But I also had was responsible at that time to change the Civil Service Commission into the Department of Human Resources, give it a whole new entity, if you will. So because it dealt with the hiring and the firing, it dealt with the unions, and it dealt with the third thing, whatever it is. Can't think of it right now. But so it was. So we created the Department of Human Resources while I was minister.
And what were some of the key things that you needed to get a handle on when you first took on the job as minister?
We spent a lot of time not only with the goings on of the department and the workings of the department and getting to know your deputy minister, the different issues within the department. We also spent a lot of time talking about ethics in government, about open government, communications within government. When we were elected in 1993, there were no computers in the minister's offices. You know, my secretary gave me a dictaphone. and I'm sitting there thinking, we have computers for this now, you know. So just the actual day-to-day workings, it was really, I think, difficult for all of us in that cabinet to bring it into the, to have either a pager or a cell phone, you know, or a computer in your office so you could communicate with one another. So the departments could communicate. It was, each department was, well, they talk about it, and they still talk about it, all being silos rather than working across government.
When you say ethics in government,
we had seminars on it. The Premier Savage set it all up. Was one of his goals was to bring ethics into government, because there's a lot of scandal in the day, and there was also a lot of favoritism and patronage and all that sort of thing that he tried to change. And much to the Liberals, did not appreciate that. Well, we didn't fire all the Tories and hire Liberals and all the different, you know, especially the Department of Transportation and those areas. And so we paid a price for that. And I think that not only do you have patronage from a political point of view, you'll get patronage and within departments, you know, hiring family and hiring friends right within the departments. Mm-hmm. But the minister has nothing to do with that. It's,
you mean sort of like the managers within the department would hire their own?
Yeah.
Okay. So that was part of the...
We tried to do it from top down. I guess it never works from an ethics point of view. But we forgot to tell the people of Nova Scotia what the problems were. We just tried to solve all the problems that we knew they had. And they didn't appreciate it. Mm-hmm. The Liberals didn't appreciate what we were doing, because they were all waiting for their chance to, you know, work on the highways and work with here, you know, and that, you know, hire just teachers or all the rest of it, so... Made it difficult. And on top of all of that, when we were elected, there hadn't been a budget. They were 3 months past budget time. Tawny Cameron didn't bring in a budget. Half the money was spent. By law, you can spend half of the money before the actual budget is passed or the estimates are passed. So we looked at the books, and there was a $600 million deficit with a $9 billion debt. there was no money to spend. You know, and it was, so we did a lot of things within the public service and a lot of things within to make money as well as cut expenses. We brought in what they called the Savage Days. We gave them 5 days off at Christmas without pay. Savage Days.
That wouldn't have been popular, I imagine.
No. And then we cut salaries by anybody who received any funding from the provincial government, regardless of where they worked in the province, or even if their funding was partially funded by government, lost 2% of their salary. And my daughter was working for the municipality. She was working in Wolfville as a recreation director, making no money, and it took 2% of her salary from her. So it really did. It really was a drastic cut. It was going to be a $673 million deficit was projected. So we cut it down under 300. We had to find 300. It was sort of an arbitrary number that we chose to lessen it by half.
So I'm curious how a decision like that would have been made in that government. Was it a finance minister decision, a whole cabinet decision? Was caucus included?
It was a cabinet decision in the end. Mm-hmm. the Department of Finance and the Minister of Finance brought in all the proposals. So you sit in cabinet and you weigh it all out. And then you weigh it all out, first of all, from a finance point of view, and strictly looking at numbers. And then what we didn't take into consideration, we just said we can't think politically because we can't survive. This province can't survive if we don't do something. So and we took a major political hit with that budget. So the Minister of Finance takes the lead.
Right. And you would have all had an opportunity to comment and weigh in on it before it would have been.
Yeah. And John Savage had, his advisors just about fell over when one of the debates or one of the interviews during the election had said no new taxes. We brought in taxes. We raised the GST. You know, and it was just, you know, and he took a major political hit on that. You know, Johnny is a liar. You'd hear from that sort of thing because we had to bring in taxes. We had to raise money as well as cut expenditures. And then what we did at the same time as well as do all that is that we also re-engineered government. So we were making changes. You know, people were confused. You know, are you making that change to save money or are you making it to because you're changing the policy and how government works? It was a really interesting time. I'm glad I was there to do it. I always said at the time, the next administration will come in and either take the credit for what we've done or they'll ruin it. And I would say that the next administration did spend money. But I would say that John Hamm, when he came in, was one of Nova Scotia's better premiers. You know, he didn't have good horses around him, but he is a stand-up, very astute, clever man. And you know, he was a Tory, and I know him well. He was in opposition when we were in government. He got a lot of credit for stuff that we did. So
that's politics. Somebody else is getting credit for things he might have done.
Yeah, yeah.
So while you were in cabinet, what portfolios did you hold over the term?
Well, I created the Department of Human Resources, and right. then there was the need to make changes within the once that was done. There was a need, I can't remember the reason why, but I was moved from there to the Department of Housing and Consumer Affairs. And at that time, I still had the Sport and Recreation Commission, and I still had the Status of Women, but I also got the Nova Scotia Liquor Commission and the Gambling Control Act. Can't remember the word. So I had I had a lot of other minor responsibilities, so it was just nonstop. So when I went to Housing and Consumer Affairs, we were at the same time deciding to make some changes within the departments, and we moved housing into municipal affairs. So I dismantled the Department of Housing and Consumer Affairs and ended up, I remember the day that we made the decision that we would move housing. Housing went to municipal affairs and consumer services went to another entity. So I just remember looking around the cabinet room and I said, well, I don't have a place to go tomorrow. My department's going to be gone. And then he did a major shuffle and he put me in natural resources, which at that time was huge. It was mining, forestry, parks and protected areas, energy, wildlife. So it was a huge department at the time. But at that time, we were negotiating with Sable Offshore Energy Project for drilling for gas off of Sable Island. So that landed. I walked into that, trying to deal with the Texans.
The Texans.
With Shell and
right.
the consortium that made up the, uh-huh. the offshore energy project.
And what was the issue you would have been dealing with?
Number one was the royalties and for the gas. And the second to that was also the pipeline that was going to be Maritime's Northeast Pipeline. I had to negotiate with them to bring the gas ashore and take it right across the province of New Brunswick in the direction it was going to go. I went into Natural Resources, I think it was the 1st of May or the end of April, April 30th maybe, probably the end of the fiscal year. And middle of May, about 3 weeks later, I had to make a presentation in Houston to the major oil and gas consortiums, and it was a major conference, a convention in Houston, Texas.
And there you're talking about royalties or the...
Well, that was just talking about energy and some of the things we were doing in Nova Scotia.
To attract
investors and to learn how the different royalties were set up around the world, actually. And I had a lot of advisors and advice and assistance. I mean, I was... But I still had to be... take responsibility for the decisions in the end. Mm-hmm. So we set up the royalty regime for the gas and for just that project. And then we're in the process of setting up a generic regime for any gas or oil that was going to come into the province after the fact. So you had to work with the federal government on that as well, because mm-hmm. they're involved with that as well.
Okay. And is that like a, so I'm curious, there's the provincial government, the federal government, I assume the companies that are involved in extracting the natural gas have a role to play in those negotiations. Would it be negotiations that you'd be?
Yeah, yes, yeah, yeah.
How would that, something like an agreement on royalties, end up shaking down?
Well, I walked out of the room once, you know, just because I knew what I, you know, I knew, well, I met with advice that I had, just, you know, because you set up a regime over the period of 20 years and in a certain percentage, and I can't give you all the complete detail now, but there was a percentage over the first 5 years and some for the second and some for the next 10 and then for the 15 into the 20. And I wanted to go to 35% at the tail end of it. And they didn't want to go to 35%. And we came to a stalemate and I just left the room. And I got my 35% before we finished. So. Hmm. And it was, they had some major upfront costs that we had to take into consideration for them as well. So, you know, it was, you had to realize. So the early on, you kept the royalty percentage low enough so they could, they call them sunk costs or upfront costs. And they used to talk about upstream and downstream, and I could never keep it straight which way was up and which way when they talked about the process. I still can't get it quite straight if it was upstream or downstream.
Right. A lot of time we, almost in a conspiratorial way, you hear often about like what the corporate influence in government is, or, you know, is there a corporate influence, or how much of it if there is one? And it's hard to know how these kind of conversations would go. We don't often get to hear about it.
Yeah, there was. I don't know about so much influence as maybe bits of pressure or requests and debate with the municipal unit. With the, for instance, in Guysborough County where the gas came ashore, the municipality and the economic development group from there, you know, were, you know, always wanting to meet with me or with the premier or with our group to express their concerns or their wishes. And you get the federal government was the hardest to deal with, actually. I don't know if the debate's ever been settled or not. It seems to me that it may be by now, but it's like who owns that gas or who has the, mm-hmm. who is entitled to the royalties for the gas when it's offshore? You know, with, when it's, Sable Island actually is part of Nova Scotia. So, it, you know, it was, so they had the federal government to deal with and, as well as the consortium of the Sable project. And I had an interview with Paul Withers, and we also had our critics, people from, especially from Alberta, that knew all about gas and oil, that tried to tell us we were doing the wrong thing or whatever. I remember Paul Withers making a comment to me about, you know, how can, you know, Eleanor Norrie, you know, a school teacher from Toro, deal with the Texans, with the, you know, the big wheelers and dealers from gas and oil industry, you know. Yeah, and I just said, you know, that I got, well, it actually annoyed me. It insulted me. Uh-huh. You know, and I responded like it was insulted. Like, I'm a Nova Scotian, and I'm looking after Nova Scotian interests, you know, that sort of thing. Uh-huh. And Don Down had been in natural resources prior to me, so he had involved him in the question. And I've always wished I had said, Don Down is a farmer, and I came from a farming family. And if you've ever tried to deal with a farmer, they can out-deal any gas and oil dealer or wheeler. Wheeler dealer. I wish I'd said that, but anyway, I didn't.
The beginning, we talked about what led you into politics. You mentioned sort of this looking in when you visited the legislature in high school. I'm curious how, obviously there was more women when you were elected, but not many.
Four, really, four of us. Actually, there are five, count Alexa.
What was the experience like for you being one of the very few women in the legislature and the cabinet?
I have a saying that I was part of the community. I was part of the we. Over there, those people that are elected are they. So it's the we and the they. Because you'll hear people say, they are doing this to us. They are like, who's they? You know, you hear that all the time, they and them. The day after I was elected, the community doesn't treat you as part of the we anymore. You're the they. So you become they. So you become somebody that either they want to be with or they want to attack. Like it's you're separate apart from the community. It's just it's what happens. Then on top of that, when you're a woman, I call it the she they. Because you become then, not only are you they in government, you're a woman in government. And people did have a hard time accepting that, especially in cabinet. I had several experiences of people, I don't know how to say it exactly, but I was Minister of Sport and Recreation. The House was sitting, and there was a major bonds bill. I think, I don't know what it was, the Nova Scotia Championships were taking place at the Mayfair Curling Link. And they invited me to come, and as the opening, part of the opening. The House was sitting, I had question period, and I had to get from the House to the curling rink. I had very little time to spare. My daughter happened to be in Halifax, and she said, I'll drive you down. So she came and got me, whisked me down there. We pulled up, and there was a parking place right by the door. I said, oh, good, there's a spot right there, because the parking places were all filled. She was driving, and she pulled in, and there was a man standing there, looking very important. He came running over to the car, and he said, you can't park there. That's for the minister, and he's not here yet. I am the minister. You'd run into that more and more and more, that people would expect me to be a man, and then if I wasn't, they didn't know quite what to do with me. And I think, you know, I think all women at that time, like Sandy Jolly was also in cabinet, and is a female. So the two of us, we tried not to join forces. At least I tried not to. I tried to be part of the whole. I had difficulty with that, and I actually, the day that you were there at the MLAs, he had asked, Jeremy Akerman had asked a couple of us to speak about our experiences at the dinner, and that was part of my speech. And you had right down that whole road about the we they. You know, I sort of, and Howard Epstein had written the book, and he talked about the same sort of thing, about you expect your position to receive respect, you know, because it's not you, it's your position. And I think there has to be respect for that position. I think some ministers and some MLAs think that it's a personal thing, and I tried not to make it a personal thing. I didn't want people to treat me any different than Eleanor Norrie that I always was. But I did expect some respect from the point of view that I was the minister of the crown, you know, that I was in that position deserves the respect.
And, yeah, you kind of mentioned how it sort of affected your perception in the community or the treatment that you would have had in the community around the cabinet table, around the caucus table, or in the legislature. Yeah, I guess would you have been treated differently in that space as well?
A couple of times. Yeah, a couple of times. It was from a question period point of view.
How so?
Yeah, a little condescending, you know, especially the experienced former cabinet ministers that were in opposition, right. You know. Who knew more than any of us did in our cabinet, because I think it was not only, I think there were two in cabinet that had been in cabinet before, under Regan's, Guy Brown and Bill Gillis. They had been in cabinet prior to that. Up until then, everybody, they mostly were always in opposition. I think there was a couple that had been there, like Joe Casey, who had been a backbencher in the past. So, you'd get that strictly from we know more than you do point of view, or then as a woman. And I remember answering a question, I'm not going to name any names here, in the House, and it had to do with the offshore. And I was being attacked about, you know, the regime that it was coming forward, or the pipeline, I can't remember the issue at the time. And I had a quote from a former minister that I used. I managed to get it through the department and sort of threw it back in my answer. And that former cabinet minister was so mad, at the end of question period, just as the speakers were changing to the deputy speaker, and I was sitting right by the speakers, it came right around to my desk and pounded my desk. And just, you know, I had no right to throw that at. Like, just, I mean, he would never have done that to a man. But the speaker didn't see it, or at least the deputy speaker claims they didn't see it happening. And when the House went into the Committee of the Whole, I stood up at a point of privilege and mentioned it. But, and I took exception to it and demanded an apology. And now, none came, and the Speaker didn't see it, so they didn't rule on it. But the next day, I got an apology. And all the women in the House at the time wanted me to join forces with them and really make an issue out of it. I said, no, this is not...
Was that particular experience or the general experience of...
What was the question?
About that particular issue you had encountered,
yeah.
Or about the general kind of experience?
I would say particular, there were particular issues, but I think overall, on the whole, it was all a very good experience, and I think that I would encourage any woman to get involved and be a role model for women.
You're saying you think it's, earlier you were saying you think it's shifted now.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I think that I wish they wouldn't talk about gender parity. I wish they wouldn't say it that way. There has to be, and I think Justin Trudeau said, in order to make it happen, had to say there'll be parity. And had to, you know, I'll make it 50-50 rather than say I'm going to have, you know, but why not say, you know, why is it the women are making parity? Why don't they do it the other way around? We're going to have just as many men as we have women.
Right.
You know, I think that, but this is a step. I think it's a step in the right direction. Mm-hmm. So you have to go through those painful steps, I guess, to get to where you want to go.
We've talked a lot about your experience as minister and in cabinet and the legislature. I'm curious how you would have approached kind of the learning curve and the expectations of being the MLA for this area.
The other day we were talking about it when we met as ex-MLAs, which I like to say former rather than ex, but anyway, what would you have done differently? And some people approached it, how would you have governed differently? Mm-hmm. And other people approached it as how they personally would have done it different. Like it was different ones. We all looked at the question a different way. And some people felt that there was too much partisanship. There's too much political wrangling rather than government as such. But my experience was that because I was so green, I'll put that way, and I was a newly elected, right into cabinet, had to go in and suffer through question period, which used to give me anxiety. And, you know, because some days those opposition members would pick on one minister, and everybody would ask that one minister a question. You'd be on your feet all afternoon. They don't do that so much now, I don't think. I think, looking back, are you in government to govern? Are you there to be re-elected? Like, why are you there? So I was thought I was there to govern. So I tried to answer the questions and got myself into trouble more often than not by trying to answer the question that would be, the answer would maybe not be politically smart. So I think that if I had to do it over again, I would be a little bit more political. I tried to be honest and answer the question, but I didn't get reelected. So what do I want to do? Do I want to, you know, so I think it's something that has to be weighed. So as an MLA, you have your constituency, which in those days was very poorly funded. I used to have to subsidize my office personally because, you gave your poor secretary who did most of your work for you when you were, especially when you were in cabinet, they would have to face the maddening crowds. I think that there should have been, and I think it's better now. I think they have better compensation because that is paid for by the government. You put in your expense and all that sort of thing. I enjoyed being an MLA. I enjoyed the experience. I was there for 5 years. Worked hard, worked really hard, and I think most do. And I had to be in Halifax every 3 days a week at least for cabinet and priorities and planning and for caucus. So and then I'd be in my minister's office. So I'd get up at 5 and I'd be in Halifax by 7 in my office. Remember there was a bunch of calls I had to return and I was in the office and the calls were sitting there. So I thought, oh, I've got some time now, I'll call. It was a guy in Stewie. I got him out of bed like it was 7 o'clock in the morning. It wasn't dawning on me that maybe I should wait till 9 before I call anybody. My secretary used to worry about me. I wouldn't have lunch. I'd come in and there'd be a sandwich sitting on my desk. It was fun. I enjoyed working with the Liquor Commission. What a time. My secretary used to call them the boys.
The boys?
The boys. The boys of the Liquor Commission.
Because they're all boys.
They're all boys.
What would you say were the more challenging issues you had to deal with, or the most challenging issues you would have dealt with as MLA or as the minister?
Well, as an MLA, my riding has the teachers' college, the agricultural college, the Nova Scotia Youth Training Center. It had natural resources offices. I would say one of the largest employees in the community was the provincial government. We took 2% salary from them. We closed the Nova Scotia Teachers College. We closed the Youth Training Center. So, as a government in that 5 years. So it was a difficult time to be the MLA from the area, to try to improve the situation here, but at the same time, when that happened, it meant a major change in how services were delivered, and also a major change in the employee status. You know, a lot of them lost their jobs. Mm-hmm. So it was a challenge to be the MLA while we were making those tough decisions.
And was there, I guess, ever any, there's like holding that dual tension of being part of the cabinet that needs to reduce costs and, you know, consider perhaps better ways of training teachers and kind of the local MLA, being that local MLA, was there kind of a, did that ever a consideration of rejecting that decision or going against that kind of
so
decision?
I was asked by somebody that was a bit of an advisor and a supporter, sitting sort of talking about the future when I was still elected, and saying to me, you know, did you ever consider resigning because this was happening within your riding? And my answer was no. I never ever considered crossing the floor or resigning because I felt that those decisions were all being made for the right reasons. That's where I was saying that, did I want to reinvent government and govern, or did I want to be political? So, you know, different people say, I wonder what would have happened if I had said to John Savage, you know, if you close the Normal College, Teachers College, I'm the representative from the area, I'm either going to vote against it. It wasn't an actual vote in the House, but I'm either going to speak out against it and you can fire me or I'll have to leave. I never thought of doing that, ever. I just knew that if I couldn't be part of the right decision, I don't know if I could have stayed there. Whether stay there within the Liberal caucus and go as an independent or just resign, period. I don't know that I could have done that. Because I don't have a whole lot of admiration for people who cross the floor for political reasons. Now, Scott Bryson, for instance, his party left him, is how he said it. And I have to admire him and his standing for what he did. But others, I don't know that I necessarily agree if it's a political decision that they leave or they cross the floor or go into opposition. So I never thought of doing that, but different people will ask me now, what do you think would have happened if you had done that? And I guess it's something interesting to think about.
And we interviewed in the legislature the environment minister from John Hamm and Rodney McDonald's government, or I guess just Rodney McDonald's government, Mark Perron, and he shared the difference between his experience working in church where he was minister and then in government where he's minister is that in church there's always, you know, there's still arguments and there's politics, he said, but in the church, you have like a moral compass to point to. You have the Bible, you have scripture, you have teachings, you have, you know, everything that the church is based on. And he said, in government, the only thing close to a moral compass or a moral reference point is it going to get us reelected? And it seems like that is very easy for a lot of politicians to fall into as a default versus kind of what you've articulated is, you know, it was the right decision. Do you have a sense of why it's not more common? I mean, it seems to be it's pretty accepted that politicians do things to get reelected versus...
You know, you get elected, so your first reason to be is to get reelected. I don't know if that's a road that I would take. I didn't do anything to get reelected, so I didn't get reelected. So and John Savage was the same way. I really admired him, and he was highly intelligent. Did everything for the right reasons. But his background, and when he was elected, one of the criticisms or one of the things people saw coming was the fact that he was very left wing. They used to call him the pinko. You know, use all those terrible words. And I remember meeting with him one time, and he was really being crucified. And he was not comfortable in what was happening, because it was almost against his personal thinking of being, you know, very left-wing. So our government ended up being very right-wing in our approach to how we govern.
But you would still describe him as a person who's very left-wing?
Yeah, he was very left-wing, so what he was doing was against his grain, if you will, and right. So it made him uncomfortable, but he was doing it for the right reasons, as opposed to being the left reasons.
Doing the right thing for the left reasons.
Yeah.
That's interesting. We're also asking, kind of touched on this a little bit, you know, if you were to, and maybe you have advised people who are seeking elected office or who have recently become MLAs on things to consider or things to keep in mind that might not be necessarily intuitive, but, you know, at the end of 5 years or however many years experience, you've kind of learned as been helpful to to doing the job, what would you suggest to somebody new to or considering becoming an MLA?
I think that if anybody came to me and said, do you think I should run? I would say yes. If you've been approached to run for any party or for any elected office, and if you're interested, I think it's a terrific experience. The door opens very rarely to a very few people in the world and gives you an opportunity to really contribute to your community. So do it. Then if they say, what advice would you give me when I run? It's be true to yourself. Decide what you want to accomplish, you know, and go down that road. Now, if you're running for municipal government, there's no party affiliation, so you're pretty well able to then deal with your constituents and try to deliver the sorts of things they want. In a party system, and it's an ongoing argument, are you representing the government in the House of Assembly, or are you representing your people in the House of Assembly? So it's an ongoing argument, so you have to decide. If you're going to run, are you going to run to represent the people and do their wishes, or are you going to be part of a government, and brings up the issue again about being in opposition and being in government. When you're in opposition, you can fight for your constituents and say everything they want done in your riding because you're asking somebody else to do it. But then when you have to do it, it's a different story. So you have to decide what you want to accomplish. So it's.
And in terms of, I guess, beyond sort of the philosophical decisions that they're going to have to make when it comes to sort of the practical pieces of advice for doing the job, what would you suggest?
Keep your sense of humor. Mm-hmm. And I didn't always. You know, I took it very seriously. I was too serious, maybe. I thought I was supposed to be. You know, and I guess I don't think I would change my approach. I don't know if I answered your question. I went down another road on you, but
that's okay.
You know, I just think, keep your sense of humor, remain true to yourself. Remember, you're part of the community. You represent not only yourself, but your family and the people of the riding. You're not only representing your party, you're representing everybody in the riding. You're the MLA for the whole riding. I don't know what you asked me. What did you ask me?
Practical tips. Yeah. That's helpful.
So, you know, fine. Have good support around you. Mm-hmm. You need good assistance around you. You need good advisors around you. It's not a one-man show or a one-woman show. It's
right.
I would suggest if I had any advice for that young man right there is have good people around you. And they were making a comment just as you arrived. When he ran, he owes nobody anything. He doesn't have a history of people supporting him to a point where he has to do them any favors. He's not in that position where a lot of MLAs or a lot of MPs or leaders will have people they have to repay, if you will. I can't think of the word I want. But they made the point that he doesn't have that. He doesn't have anybody he has to, whether it's individuals or whether it's other forms of government or whether it's corporations or whatever. I never thought of it till I heard one of the reporters say that, and I just thought that's a really good point. Mm-hmm. He's his own man, and he'll make his decisions, and he'll have people around him and that he doesn't owe anything to.
Looking at having lived through the experience of working in the legislature, a lot of people look at the legislature and are confused or frustrated by what they see in there. Having worked there and been there for some time, we always frame this as sort of, organizational exit interviews, it's kind of the opportunity to share feedback on how the workplace can be improved, knowing that the people leaving have some of the best wisdom about kind of the organization by the time they leave. Looking at the way the legislature operates, the way politics operates in Nova Scotia, would there be anything you'd change or like to see improve?
I think the media has an awful lot to do with that, whether how they portray it or how people play to the media. I'd like to see the media be in a position. So right now, I don't know if I want to say this on that or not, but is that they're making a rock star out of Justin Trudeau, which is very dangerous for him personally. So that I think the media has a role to play. And I think if we could change anything, it would be the relationship with the media, between the media and the public and the media and the elected officials. So I don't know that cameras in the House of Assembly are necessarily a good thing. People play to the camera. It's nice to be open, and it's nice if the public can be a part of that and see all of that, as long as it's not used in a detrimental way. So I guess less partisanship in that, you know, and I made this comment the other day, is that, you know, they were all talking about having, you know, they were all making the comments about, you know, being more cooperative and collegial across the floor and that sort of thing, and be less partisan. And if somebody in the opposition has a good idea, why can't the government, you know, accept it? Or why doesn't the opposition, if they see the government doing something right, accept it without? So I think less partisanship. Although, then again, I'll come back and say, I wasn't partisanship enough. I wasn't part, you know.
Yeah. So. But you sound like you might not have been the typical partisan. And perhaps some people could do less of it.
Yeah. I think there was occasions when I, doing the right thing also played into the fact that, you know, it was partisan at the same time.
But right.
I guess it was, if it was more balanced from that point of view. You know, and the rules in the House of Assembly and how committees are formed, and, you know, that sort of thing. I think I don't know how you would improve it, but I think there's room for improvement.
Thanks for listening to this episode of On the Record Off Script. We will be back again with full episodes in September, and in the meantime, stay tuned for more interviews like this one, where we give you a bit of a behind-the-scenes look at what the podcast is made up of and some of the more interesting conversations we had with former MLAs from all parties and all walks of life. If you haven't done so yet, take a minute and head over to the podcast page on Apple Podcasts and give this podcast a rating. It means a lot to us. It means that people with interests similar to yours can have an easier time finding podcasts like this one that they presumably would also like. And if you haven't had a chance to consider donating, consider going to offscript.ca/donate and signing up to be a donor for $3, $5, $8 a month, whatever you feel this podcast is worth to you.